Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, as part of our ongoing series, Government from the Inside, we welcome San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Gideon versus Wainwright, which guaranteed the right to a lawyer to all people charged with a crime, regardless of their ability to afford one. And no better time, it seems, to discuss this with San Francisco's public defender Jeff Adachi and how this particular landmark decision is enforced today and how it perhaps any challenges to it in the future. Mr. Adachi, who represents he and his colleagues represent 23,000 people each year charged with felony and misdemeanor offenses, and they go to court to help these individuals not only avoid incarceration, but also try to keep them out of the court system to begin with. It includes a zealous advocacy outside of the courtroom to reduce recidivism, keep kids in school and out of the system, and help ex-inmates reenter society. And it arguably encompasses even broader efforts to root out some of the most intractable problems facing vulnerable populations, including racial bias and inadequate funds for necessary services. So tonight, we ask Mr. Adachi how successful he and his colleagues have been in these efforts. To what extent does his approach to law enforcement align with those of the DA's office and the police department? And what challenges persist in ensuring equal justice for all in our city? Joining me in the studio to discuss these questions is San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi. Before being elected as public defender in March 2002, he worked as a deputy public defender in San Francisco for 15 years. And in private practice for 2 years. From 98 to 2001, he served as the chief attorney of the public defender's office. He's tried over 150 jury trials, including numerous serious felony and homicide cases, and has handled over 3,000 criminal matters throughout his career, including some of the Bay Area's highest profile cases. Mr. Adachi is also a pension reform advocate for public employees, a one-time candidate for mayor of San Francisco, and a filmmaker whose credits include The Slanted Screen, a 2006 documentary film about stereotypical depictions of Asian males in American cinema. Welcome, Jeff Adachi.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here, Joseph. It's great being here.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment at the KLW website, or on our Facebook page. So, Jeff Adachi, I'd like to hear a little bit about what you think in August of 2013 is the state of the institution of defending those who cannot afford a lawyer, those people who are entrusted to your care. And I would ask you to talk about that both on the San Francisco level and perhaps on the national landscape.
Well, here in San Francisco, as public defender, I have the responsibility of providing legal representation to about 20,000 people a year. I have a staff of 92 attorneys and 80 support staff. So it's a huge responsibility because you're talking about life and death. You're talking about people who are looking at imprisonment accused of crimes. And at the same time, you know, we generally have a lot of folks that we're called on to represent every year. The way we're appointed on cases is that the court, when a person is arrested and taken into custody, will ask the person, can you afford an attorney? And if a person cannot afford an attorney, the public defender is appointed. And so we don't control the number of cases that come to us. And that's true of most public defenders where you have these huge caseloads. And as you mentioned, this year is the 50th anniversary of the United States Supreme Court's decision. It's a very famous decision called the Gideon case, where the court declared that, yes, there is a right to a lawyer. We've had the right to a lawyer in the Sixth Amendment as part of our Bill of Rights in 1791. But in fact, it's a promise that hasn't been fulfilled. Prior to 1963, 50 years ago, when the Gideon case was decided, get this, you had to be charged with a capital case in order to be provided a lawyer at state's expense, which meant if you couldn't afford a lawyer, you had two choices. You either pled guilty or you represented yourself. And Gideon was a convicted a burglar. He was convicted of burglarizing a pool hall, was forced to represent himself. and appealed to the United States Supreme Court and said, hey, wait a minute, I have a right to a lawyer. The Supreme Court said, you know what? We agree with you. He was appointed a public defender and he was acquitted. Hmm. So that's that, you know, that was 50 years ago. But today we're still struggling with not having the resources we need to provide adequate representation.
So is that basically what it boils down to, that the law is on your side, but it's a not fully funded mandate?
Well, you know, when the founders of this country said there's a right to a lawyer, their heart was in the right place because they understood how important it was to have a lawyer. They knew what it was like to be prosecuted by the British Crown. And so they said, you know what, we're going to put this in the Bill of Rights. They didn't say who was going to pay for it. And that's what Gideon did. Gideon said the state has the obligation of paying for these costs. However, they didn't say that it had to be funded adequately. And so what you had and what you still have today is public defender offices that are under-resourced, understaffed, that have huge caseloads. Now, fortunately, we're not in that situation here in San Francisco, but there are public defender offices in other parts of the country where lawyers are handling as many as 500 felony cases at one time. And that's insane. How can you possibly provide adequate representation? In other places, even in California, lawyers are given a flat rate to represent somebody. So if you're representing somebody on a misdemeanor case, they'll say, oh, here's $100. And it doesn't matter whether you go to trial or not. And so what's going to happen? Those clients are pled guilty. So again, it's always a situation of resources. And public defenders, for the most part, have been treated like the stepchild of the criminal justice system. You have a police department, a sheriff's department, a district attorney's office, which is generally well-funded, and public defenders usually are not. And so that's something that I certainly have fought to change as public defender.
And what's the average caseload of one of your attorneys?
When I started in the office 27 years ago as a misdemeanor attorney, I had 300 cases at any given time. And so when I became public defender, one of the first things I did is I said, we have to institute reasonable caseloads. And so my attorneys still work very hard now, but in the misdemeanor division, on average, they have about 70 misdemeanor cases at any given time. And in felonies, they have between 40 and 50. So my attorneys are still working 50 to 60 hours a week, but it's a manageable caseload. And what we do now is we look at the seriousness of the case. I mean, a murder case is very different than a misdemeanor case, obviously. And so we ensure that our caseloads are such that a attorney who's working a 50 or 60 hour week is able to handle the case. So that means being accountable to the client, seeing the clients, filing the motions, doing the investigation, all the things that you would expect if you were to hire an attorney.
So what did you do, or how did you transform that ratio of attorneys to clients? What arguments did you make, and how did it all turn out?
Well, two things. One, I advocated for more staffing. And when I came into office, I met with Mayor Willie Brown, who was the mayor then, and said, you know what, we can no longer continue to provide this sort of hit and miss representation we've done in the past. And, you know, Willie Brown is criminal defense attorney, so he actually agreed with me and gave us more staffing. The second thing is that when our caseload has gotten too large for us to handle, I have declined cases. And I'm the only elected public defender in the state. And I think Florida and Alaska, of all places, elects their public defenders. And everywhere else, a public defender is appointed. And so you're not on equal footing with the district attorney, because the district attorneys are elected and they have the bully pulpit that they can stand from and say, we want more staffing, law and order. Whereas public defenders often, you know, are not seen as part of law enforcement, and it's easier to underfund them because they don't have a, you know, popular constituent. However, what I did in San Francisco is said, you know what, people should care about justice. It's not right that a poor person receives a poor quality of justice than a person with means. And I think most people get that. Most people understand that if you're going to have a justice system and justice for all, that you have to properly fund public defenders.
So are public defenders actually allowed to refuse cases? I was under the impression that they weren't.
Yeah, in some states, they're not allowed to refuse cases. And in fact, there was a big lawsuit in Florida. I was just talking to the public defender of Dade County, and they had to go to court and fight for, I think, 5 years. And finally, the Supreme Court said, yes, you have the right to decline cases. Because what happens is, if you're an incompetent lawyer, you could be disbarred. You could get in huge, you know, trouble if you're not providing adequate representation to people. Why? Because innocent people can get convicted. And in fact, in some places around the country, this has happened, where attorneys have taken on too much work and they've either been disbarred or found to be incompetent. And so, you know, the argument that I've made is, if you have incompetent lawyering, it actually costs more, because you're running the risk of locking up innocent people. At the same time, if a lawyer is found to be incompetent, not only can the city be liable, but the conviction, if the person is convicted, you know, would be reversed. So by properly funding public defenders, what you're really doing is ensuring that our justice system works.
Mm. And when was the last time you had to refuse a case?
It must have been, let's see, about 3 years ago. We had a situation where our staffing was being cut. And sometimes the city will say, okay, we're going to cut everyone's staff by 10%. The problem is, we can't cut our service by 10%. I can't say to you, Joseph, I'm sorry, we can't investigate your case. You want to exercise your right to a trial. I don't have anyone to try your case. I guess you have to wait in jail for 2 years. You know, there are some places where that happens, where people are kept in jail for in some cases, you know, months and months, because there's no lawyers to handle their cases. And fortunately, in San Francisco, you know, we haven't had to fight that battle. And I have to say that the Board of Supervisors and the mayor, I worked under three mayors so far, have all been very supportive of public defense. That's not to say that I have to fight sometimes in order to get the resources that we need, but generally, the San Francisco Public Defender's Office, you know, is better resource than most.
Hmm. So let's shift gears a little bit from the investigation and representing people in court to tell us about a little bit more about the other things that you do as part of that you believe are part of your charge for representing the communities that you serve in terms of innovation or other programs that try to get at avoiding incarceration or even people even getting to the point of being arrested.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I always joke about is that I'd actually like to put myself out of business, if that's possible. And, you know, the worst thing as a public defender is you represent a client, maybe win an acquittal or get a good disposition of his or her case, and then the client's back. And so to the extent that we can help people avoid coming back into the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system, that's an outcome that we want. So In my office, what we've done is, for example, in our juvenile division, we represent about 1,000 kids every year. We have social workers there who immediately work with kids and help link them to services, you know, and their families. We have a lot of prevention programs that we offer through our office. In the adult unit as well, we have different courts. They're called collaborative courts, where individuals who are charged with crimes are offered services instead of jail time. And, you know, to the extent that we can fashion outcomes that are not only going to provide good legal outcomes, but good social outcomes for people, we have an obligation to do that. One of the programs I'm very proud of is called the Clean Slate Program. And this is a program I started in 1998 when I was the chief attorney of the office. And under the law, after you've completed probation or you completed your sentence on a crime, you can actually get your record cleared. It's called an expungement. And you have to, it's a legal process that you have to go through to show that you've rehabilitated yourself and you turned your life around. But if you've done that, you can qualify to have it taken off your record. Because when you have a conviction on your record, it could affect your employability, housing, you know, education. All these things are going to be affected by your prior record. And so before we started this program, we were clearing maybe, 50 or 60 records a year. I'm very proud to say that last year we cleared almost 2,000 records. And so we've had this program now for 15 years this year, and we've cleared, you know, probably between 20 and 25,000 records during that time. So we have clinics in the community. If you go to our website at sfpublicdefender.org, people can find out, you know, how to get their record cleared. And it's a great service for folks because it gives them hope. You know, if you've been convicted of a crime and, you know, you're thinking, you know, how can I turn my life around? Well, this is one way. That's why we call it Clean Slate, because you can start again.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that threshold that people have to achieve in order to have their records expunged. What do people have to prove?
Well, you know, for most people, you have to show that you have a job, that you're doing something positive with your life. Some people are involved with community or church, others in education. And so we actually submit a petition to the court showing how a person has made these positive changes in their lives. And it used to be so hard to get an expungement because public defenders, you know, maybe didn't have the time to bring the cases back to court, you know, 3 years or 5 years after the date of conviction. But we really made this a priority by having a staff, you know, who handles these cases. And we're able to get a record cleared in a misdemeanor case 3 months, in a felony case 6 months. And it is a great thing to experience because people feel restored. That's what we want. We want people to be motivated and inspired to turn their lives around. And if we can, you know, take somebody and, you know, who is on the wrong path and make them into productive, you know, citizens, isn't that really what we want?
And do you feel like the bar is still set too high for records to be expunged, or do you feel like it's set at the right level?
Well, we've been very successful, you know, within the existing laws. However, the laws are very strict still. For example, if you've gone to state prison, you have to wait 7 years before you can even apply for an expungement. And that's one of the things I'd like to change. And I've actually, you know, talked to senators about, you know, possibly changing that law in the next few years.
And are there certain circumstances where there will be case convictions that will always remain on someone's record and nothing, they can't be expunged at all? Is anything open for?
No, there are certain convictions. I mean, sex offenses, you know, murder. But, you know, most offenses, given the passage of time and, again, that you completed all your requirements, you know, can be expunged. So, again, you know, we have drop-in hours at our office any Tuesday from 9 to 11. You don't need an appointment. You can just come in and meet with a lawyer. And then we have clinics in different communities in San Francisco.
So let's go back to what you were describing earlier, which is your prevention programs and your work with children. So tell us about the kind of work that you do in the community and what your success has been in that area.
Well, we do a number of things. Public education, I think, is very important. And so we work with the schools, and we also work with the public that we serve. We have a summit every year that we do, usually in May. And if you go online, on the SFGov TV website, you can find our summits. And these are day-long events where we talk about important criminal justice issues and also things that are interesting to the public. Like the last time we talked about neuroscience and all the developments in brain science and you know, how that has affected criminal responsibility. We 1 year brought out different authors who have written about criminal justice issues. And, you know, it's an opportunity for the public to engage on issues of criminal justice. If you think about it, what we do as public defenders intersects with so many different areas of concern in our society: poverty, obviously crime, racism, prisons, you know, misidentification, and how that affects you know, outcomes in criminal cases. And so the good thing about our work is that we do have an opportunity to affect social changes, you know, through policies that we collectively as a criminal justice community work on. The other organization I'm very proud of that we created in the Public Defender's Office is called the MAGIC Programs. These MAGIC programs, there's one in Baby Hunters Point called Be Magic, and there's another one in the Fillmore called Mo Magic for Fillmore. But these programs were created 7 and 10 years ago to really provide a support net for young people in those communities. And you might think, well, geez, you know, there must not be as much crime in Pacific Heights than there is Bayview Hunters Point among their youth. Actually, that's not true. But, you know, the difference is that in Pacific Heights, you're going to have a support net because of the resources that would be available in that community that aren't available, say, for kids in Bayview Hunters Point. And you have, you know, schools that are challenged, and you have resources that aren't going to be there in those communities. So we created these MAGIC programs, which are a collaborative of youth and family agencies that work together to improve outcomes for kids. And last weekend and the weekend before, we held a back-to-school celebration that was sponsored by the MAGIC collaboratives. And as a community, distributed over 3,500 backpacks to kids in that time, and more importantly, brought together all the resources, community-based organizations, and there are over 100 organizations that are collectively a part of the MAGIC network to improve outcomes for kids. Our Fillmore MAGIC program actually provided a literacy reading program for kids all summer, for kids to participate in everything from field trips to mentorships, for over 175 kids. So this is one way that we can make change by having the sort of support and programs so kids don't ever get into the criminal justice system to begin with.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're in conversation with San Francisco Public Defender Jeff Adachi. We open our phone lines to you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. You can call us at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment at klw.org or on our Facebook page. So let's stay with youth. I was curious to hear your perspective on what the branch point between what happens to someone, to a youth who either doesn't go into the criminal justice system or one who does, and even one who perhaps is convicted of a misdemeanor. What's the impact of being connected or being in the criminal justice system? Many people talk about the sort of lifelong imprint or impact on children. From your perspective, what do you see as some of the deleterious effects that you'd rather avoid?
Well, when you talk about a young person, particularly growing up in an urban setting like San Francisco, their experience is going to be affected obviously by their family and what support they either do or do not have, education, the school, because they're going to be there for a good part of their day, and then also the economic resources that are available to that child, usually through the parents. And, you know, the sort of intangible is the love and support that child receives. And you can pretty much guess that a child who gets all of those things is probably not going to be involved in the juvenile justice system. Whereas if you have a child who is not getting, you know, two, three, or four of those things and is in an environment where they're going to be exposed to, you know, negative role models, or, you know, they're not going to have the kind of opportunities that a child, you know, any parent knows that you want to keep your child engaged. You want to find that one sport or activity that your child is passionate about. And the sad thing that I see is that kids who wind up in the juvenile justice system are no different. They just don't have those opportunities. And what we found with many of the kids who wind up in juvenile hall is many of them have never been out of, say, a 2 or 3 mile radius of their own neighborhood. Many of the kids have not experienced, sort of the basic things that you would expect any child to need to thrive. And so, you know, part of what we're trying to do through MAGIC, the MAGIC programs, and through our work with kids is to identify early on, you know, who are the kids who are having issues and problems. Because remember, again, of the kids who get involved in the juvenile justice system, maybe 8 or 9% of those kids are going to turn out to be, you know, recidivists, or they're coming back again and again. The way that the juvenile justice system is supposed to work is that a young person is supposed to be there not for punishment, but for rehabilitation. All the studies show that when you're talking about even a teenager, they don't have that level of maturity. They don't have the frontal lobe development and maturity to understand necessarily the consequences of their act. And many of the kids who might engage in, you know, in troubling behavior when they're young age out of it. And so really what you want to do with the juvenile justice system is find out, okay, you know, where is this child having a problem? That's why one of the programs we have in my office, we have an educational advocate. It's actually a lawyer whose job it is to work with the school district to make sure that when a kid gets into trouble, because 50% of the kids who get in trouble in the justice system are there because of things that happen at school. And so what this person does is works with the school district to make sure that the kid goes back to school with services. And that's an important part of making sure that kids succeed.
And tell us about the work you do with those that are convicted and as adults, and your attempts to reduce their recidivism.
Well, with adults, I think the most important thing is that for those that are incarcerated, either in prison or are in the county jail, that we begin working with folks before they're released. Because the one reality that people have to realize is that 99% of the people who are in prison or in jail are going to be released. Many, you know, within a short period of time, a matter of a year or less. And that's even more true now because we have what's called state realignment. The governor has ordered that most low-level state prisoners are now transferred to local facilities or not even sentenced to prison to begin with. And so what that's meant is that it's created a bigger burden on, you know, local communities like San Francisco who have to find ways of addressing the needs of this very needy population. And so what we've done in San Francisco is we've started a reentry council. And we started this in 2005. It's an official body in San Francisco government. It's made up of service providers, government agencies, formerly incarcerated individuals. And we look at ways to service this population. And so we've been very successful in getting grants. I think we have something like $5 or $6 million in federal grants. San Francisco is very rich with nonprofit organizations that do this work. And so we've been able to really bring all of the diverse groups together, churches, nonprofit groups who are dedicated to prisoner reentry, and government agencies, and work together to prove outcomes. We only have about 1,000 people who are on parole here in San Francisco. The amount of people, number of people on probation, I think it's about 4,000 or 5,000. So it's a manageable group of people. We're not talking about tens of thousands like Los Angeles County. So, but the key is to find out what people's needs are early on, and help them as they're getting out, so they're not going to go back to the old their old lifestyle. And, you know, finding a job is important. Job training is important. And again, for people who would criticize this and say, well, why are you helping, you know, people who have been in trouble with the law? Again, what we're trying to do is give people opportunities so they can become productive citizens, and, you know, they can have a new chance at life.
So you also publish a guide on how to get out and stay out, or I'm not sure if that's the exact title of the
right.
But tell us a little bit about that publication, and what were some thoughts behind putting something like that together? And what are some of the things that maybe some of our listeners wouldn't even imagine are considerations for people who are coming out of incarceration?
Well, let's say you're on SSI because of disability or mental health issue, and you're getting out of prison. Well, it could take you, you know, months to get back on SSI. So that's something that if you know to apply for that, you're going to be in a much better situation when you're out. Getting medical treatment. A lot of people who are coming out of prison have serious medical issues or have drug addiction problems. So again, by letting them know who to go to and where to get these services, you know, people aren't left with sort of, you know, that information gap. And so, yeah, we came up with this guide, and you can find it online at sfreentry.org. And we now distribute it to all the prisons that release individuals and county jails here in the Bay Area. And it's been very successful. It's a it's not on the New York bestseller list yet, but it should be because every person who gets released from custody should have it. And
it's called Getting Out and Staying Out.
Yeah, it even has things like, you know, how to get a driver's license. That can be how to get a California identification. You can't cash a check without identification nowadays. And so all these basic things that people need to know. And there are things like job credits where employers can get job credits for hiring ex-offenders. And so this kind of information is included in that guide as well. So again, they can find it at sfreentry.org. And it's a very good thing.
So you're talking in the situation like this as a sort of basic life skills that,
right,
that people need to know about in order to avoid reincarceration. Tell us what it is about the fact that you have to kind of, as a public defender, you have to be putting together a booklet like this. Mm-hmm. This sounds like outside of the realm of a public defender. It sounds like, some other realm, like the social work realm, and I'm asking this question not naively, because this is the kind of conversation I had with DA Gascon about a month ago. It's tell us about how you understand the line between what you are doing and social services that potentially are fall under other disciplines. How do you understand the connection and bringing these things together under your office?
Well, our primary function is to advocate for people in court. And obviously, when a person is charged with a crime, the job of the attorney is to represent that individual zealously and make sure that we independently investigate the case, talk to witnesses, and prepare the case, you know, for court. However, in addition to seeking a good legal outcome for the case, if there is an opportunity to seek a good social outcome, then we do that. And that's part of advocacy. Let's say you have a client who's addicted to drugs. You could go to trial and fight that case if that's what the client wants, but you can also seek a drug program. And so that's also part of our advocacy. So we have social workers who help achieve that by creating social histories that we use to advocate for the client. Now, where we draw the line is we don't provide the direct service. We're not, you know, providing drug treatment to clients. That would be a conflict of interest, and it's wouldn't be something that we can handle given the thousands of people that we represent. However, you know, we link people to programs and services, and that is essential to, you know, what we do. Because if you can, again, affect a person's life by, exposing them to job skills, finding them a caseworker, about 20% of our clients suffer from mental illness and 15% severe mental illness. So to the extent that we can, you know, link them, you know, with the services that they need in order to, you know, help address their illness, that is the thing that's going to keep them, you know, off the streets and out of trouble. And I think even the most conservative person would agree with that and say, you know what, we're spending we're spending more money on prisons than we are on higher education in this state. And it's insane. And so one way that we have to stop this insanity, and it's interesting that Attorney General Eric Holder was here last week in San Francisco and made the announcement that the federal government is going to stop prosecuting low-level drug crimes. Wow, what an epiphany. It's taken how many years, 50 years on the war on drugs, and we're finally at that point. And San Francisco is way ahead.
415-841-4134 if you'd like to join our conversation with San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi here on City Visions tonight on 91.7 KLW San Francisco. If you've ever been a criminal defendant or known someone here or elsewhere, what has your experience with the public defender's office been? And what are some questions that you have for Jeff Adachi about his philosophy of preserving and defending the rights of the poor in San Francisco, those accused of a crime. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. You can also post a comment at klw.org or on our Facebook page. So I wanted to turn next to your relationship with the police department and the district attorney's office. How would you describe that relationship?
Well, you know, we do work together in the sense that we're all part of the criminal justice system, but we are the natural adversary of the district attorney. I mean, for example, I met with the district attorney and his management team today with my management team because we have policy issues that we have to talk about and resolve. But in court, you know, we're adversaries. It's an adversarial system. You know, we go toe-to-toe. I handle cases myself. When I go to court, you know, we fight, and that's what's expected. That's not to say we're getting fist fights in the hallway kind of thing, but the idea of an adversary system is that you have a defender who is zealously going to represent the rights of the accused, and you have the prosecutor who represents supposedly the interests of the government or the state. And you know, with the police department as well, we do work with them. In fact, all of their new cadets were out at the backpack giveaway we had in the past 2 weeks. They had over 50 young police officers out, which was great, out engaging in the community. However, you know, our role is to ensure that the police department is also accountable. When we had we had three scandals in the past 5 years, we had the crime lab technician who was testing drugs and using them. We had 68 police officers who had misconduct records, and under law that has to be provided to the defense, and that was not. And then most recently, we had a series of scandals at a Tenderloin Hotel, which is the subject of a number of drug busts, where police officers were barging into people's rooms without warrants, and this was all captured on videotape. And so when these kinds of things happen, as public defenders, a part of our responsibility is to, you know, hold the government accountable. And that means that we would make motions to dismiss cases based on governmental misconduct. I mean, people will say, what is your job as a public defender? In addition to representing individuals, it's our job also to uphold the Bill of Rights, right? When the founders of this country passed the Constitution, there was a pretty strong minority of people who thought the Constitution was terrible, that it gave too much power to the government. So they passed the Bill of Rights. And so the Bill of Rights defined things like the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure, and the First Amendment, the right to free speech. And many of the Bill of Rights concern the rights of a criminal defendant, a person accused of crime. And so our job is to make sure that those rights are respected. So if a police officer violates the Bill of Rights by searching somebody without a warrant, if the prosecutor commits prosecutorial misconduct, it's our job to make sure that doesn't happen.
So when I had DA Gascon and Chief Sir on the program individually over the last year, I felt that both of them seemed increasingly favorable towards finding alternatives to incarceration, finding alternative sentencing. They both talked about being more involved in their communities through community policing models, but also DA Gascon through his placing of assistant district attorneys within precincts to help work with communities. And they both spoke of understanding the sort of complex roots of criminal acts, the social situations and the things that you alluded to earlier. So in general, what could be termed as a progressive approach towards law enforcement. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on their approach. Is it, do you feel like there's money where their mouth is? Do you feel like it's rhetoric? Where are areas of agreement and an alignment between your office and theirs?
Well, this is the first time, and I've been around in a criminal justice system for 27 years. This is the first time that I've seen the police chief, the district attorney, the adult probation chief, Wendy Still, and also the juvenile. We have a new juvenile probation chief named Alan Nance, and the sheriff. Everybody is on the same page when it comes to wanting to improve outcomes for people who are in the criminal justice system, and also reducing recidivism. But the question is how you do that. And so people do have different views. The district attorney, you know, is going to be more likely to allow alternative sentencing and things like that for low-level offenders. The police department, the way that they can affect change is by arresting fewer people and only arresting and focusing on the more serious crime. One criticism that has existed about San Francisco's justice system for some time is that we spent a lot of time and resources on misdemeanor cases, on low-level drug offenses, and that's now changed. There was an article in Examiner last week talking about how the police department is arresting fewer people for drug crimes. Oh, my God, does that mean that San Francisco is going to fall in the ocean? No, that hasn't happened. And the reality is that by arresting fewer people, you know, for petty offenses and using diversion programs, doesn't mean that people get off the hook. It means that they do community service, or you have restorative justice, or you have this community justice center. These are all programs where people are diverted from the criminal justice system into treatment and programs that help them for low-level type offenses. And the positive side of that is that you have more time to deal with serious crime. Do you know that 8 years ago, the solve rate on homicide cases was about 30%? That means that if you were involved in a homicide or a murder, there's probably a 1 out of 3 chance that you would be arrested and convicted. Today, I understand the solve rate is something like 85%. And I think that's a direct result of the police department spending more time focusing on the more serious cases, which I think if you ask the average citizen on the street, they would say, yes, for my money, I would rather, in this era of limited resources, I would rather focus on serious and violent crime. And that's what we've done in San Francisco. And at the same time, it's not like people are just walking away for other crimes. It's just that you have a diversion program. And then also you have to also have a vigorous system of being able to challenge a crime that you're not guilty of. Because in my experience, I would say that you have a sizable number of accusations that turn out not to be true. And it's not always, you know, black and white. I mean, you can be charged with something and maybe you did A and not B. Or, you know, maybe you've been charged with a serious crime and really what you did was something lesser. And so you have to have a system that can determine that.
And so in speaking to some of this newfound alignment in philosophies that you talk about, that at least is new in your career here, where are there places for collaboration? Or is it necessary that your departments all sort of stay separate and have their own approaches towards law enforcement? Because it seems like, you know, if each of the three branches, so to speak, public defenders, DA's office, and the police department are also all working towards, you know, alternatives to incarceration and reducing recidivism and other things, it feels like there could be a lot of duplication of efforts and siloing of efforts. How do you break those barriers down without compromising what you need to stay separate?
Yeah, I think it's important that we keep in mind, you know, what is our primary mission? And for public defenders, our primary mission is to represent people in court and, again, advocate for the social outcomes and legal outcomes that are going to be most beneficial for the clients. And so all our efforts are focused on that. With the district attorney, their job is to prosecute. Now, what's interesting is the district attorney now has, I think, one sentencing alternative specialist to help educate district attorneys on alternative sentencing. We have people who are advocating for alternative sentencing. Will there come a day where you don't have to do this anymore and we will just have good common sense alternative sentencing that's available for everyone? You know, I'm not holding my breath, but if that happens, we won't need you know, the sort of staffing that we now devote in this area. And so I do see a transition. It used to be the probation department did very little. I mean, they would write a report on whether they thought you should get probation. And now they're starting to transform. They just opened up a service center. And, you know, if I walked into a place like that 25 years ago, I'd think I was on a different planet. But they actually have probation officers there who are providing services, who are actually helping people stay out of trouble. That would have never happened even 5 years ago. So we're seeing changes in the criminal justice system, which I think will transform eventually our roles. Now, is there always going to be a need for a forum to decide guilt or innocence? I think so. You know, there's that old Star Trek episode where I think it's Spock or Captain Kirk. They just put their hand on a device and you can tell whether they're telling the truth or not. You know, we don't have that yet. So there's no way to determine guilt or innocence except through, I think, a jury system, which is the best system that I know of. So, you know, we're always going to have a need for that.
And so where are areas of continued disagreement between you and the DA's office and the police department?
Oh, let me count the ways. Like, I mean, today we're talking to the district attorney about the fact that they don't provide us with phone numbers of the witnesses in cases. And the district attorney doesn't have to under the law. But it's crazy. It's like we're both public service agencies and we have to run around to try to find out people's phone numbers. And what it usually means is that if you're a witness in a case, I'm going to come by your house at 7 o'clock at night and say, "Hey, Joseph, how you doing? You know, tell me about what happened." You're like, "Hey, can't you call me on the phone?" "No, I don't have your phone number." And so, you know, these are the things that we sometimes argue about. The district attorney has charged a 14-year-old as an adult. And that's something that I disagree with very strongly. And I told him, I said, "Hey, I do not think that you should be charging a 14-year-old as an adult." But you know, but he chose to do that in that case. And, you know, we disagree. So, yeah, we have disagreements all the time. And I think what's different about working with this district attorney and also with the police chief is that we do try to work out policy disagreements. But, you know, then again, there are times when we're going to have different points of views, and that's a healthy thing because it brings sort of diverse opinions together. As public defender, you know, certainly my view, you know, isn't the view that everyone shares, and so, you know, by mixing it up constantly, I think the public gets the benefit of you know, putting. Different ideas together to produce greater results.
415-841-4134 to join our conversation tonight with San Francisco Public Defender Jeff Adachi here on City Visions 91.7 KLW and KLW.org. You can send us an email at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com and also post a comment at KLW.org. So in the last 10 or so minutes of the program, I wanted to focus on another area, which is to look at the justice system from the perspective of bias. This is an area that you've written about recently, and wanted to hear what your thoughts are on the state of this problem. You mentioned neuroscience quite a bit earlier in the program, and you quote that a lot in your articles. Tell us about your understanding of how bias in the justice system is really affecting the fate of disproportionately the fate of our defendants of color, particularly African Americans.
Right. You know, for years and years and years, you read about these statistics about how African American males in particular are more likely to get the death penalty, more likely to be arrested. For example, if you look per capita at the number of African Americans that use drugs versus whites that use drugs, you find a much larger percentage of whites that use drugs. Yet African American men in particular are going to be prosecuted at, you know, 4 to 5 times the rate. Same with Latinos. Now, why is that? Now, again, you could probably come up with 100 different reasons. You can say, well, drug laws are more heavily enforced in those neighborhoods. Some police officers will say, well, it's because we're going to focus on people who are dealing drugs outside, and that's more likely to be people of color. So you can come up with a lot of variables. But the fact remains is that if you look at incarceration rates, prosecution rates, who is prosecuted for what crimes, who we represent, you're going to find across the board that minorities, particularly African Americans, are overrepresented. And it's also a fact that if you look at arrest statistics, people who are stopped, look at the stop and frisk laws that were just ruled illegal last week by a federal court judge in New York City. They're overwhelmingly the people who are stopped for stop and frisk violations are minorities, are African-American and Latino men. Yet when they looked at the number of people who were found with contraband or, you know, weapons, it was less than 1%. So, you know, you find that in our society, for a number of reasons, minorities are prosecuted, jailed, and even put to death at a much higher rate than their white counterparts. Now, the question is, why does that happen? Is it because prosecutors and police and, you know, other people in law enforcement wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I'm going to go out and arrest a person of color. I'm going to go out and hassle an African-American. Certainly that does happen, but the more likely culprit is something that is now known as unconscious bias or implicit bias. And this talks about the bias that exists in all of us, and it's not just a white and black phenomenon. It's across the board. And they've done a lot of testing on this. And, for example, they did a test of judges where they showed judges different faces of people supposedly who had committed crimes and asked them to sentence them. And they found out consistently white judges would give out or met out more severe sentences to darker skinned individuals. And as they became darker, the sentences increased. Now you would think, well, wait a minute, these are judges. They had another interesting experiment where they looked at empathy. And they had a black hand, a white hand, and a purple hand. And they showed it in the study to Caucasian people. And it showed that when the white hand was pricked with a needle, there was a large, you know, feeling of empathy, which is something that they can actually measure. With a purple hand, there was a smaller amount, but still amount of empathy. With the black hand, there was no empathy. And so, you know, what these studies have shown, and these are studies that have been repeated, is that, when you're talking about things like racial profiling, when you're talking about, you know, maybe a judge feeling empathy for one person and not another, that it comes from these unconscious biases. I remember there was being a young public defender. I think I was probably right out of law school, and I was sitting in court in what they call the master calendar court at the Hall of Justice. And there was a man with his family, had a beautiful family. They were all in the front row. They were dressed, like they were in Sunday school. And this man had stolen supposedly like $800,000 from a university. And the judge looked at him and looked at his family. And the judge was Caucasian as well and said, you know, I think you learned your lesson. I'm going to sentence you probation, you know, pay back the money and don't come back. And then in the next defendant who comes up was a young African-American kid, must have been probably 19 or 20 years old. And the judge sentenced that kid to 3 years in prison for selling $20 worth of rock cocaine without even blinking. And that's the kind of thing that happens. And so you wonder, how could that happen? You know, there's been a lot been said about the Trayvon Martin case and the significance of, you know, race in that case. And I think that race had everything to do with the outcome in that case, even though it was never mentioned by the team of prosecutors, none of whom were African-American, or the defense. In that trial, if you look at, you know, why George Zimmerman reportedly stopped Trayvon Martin, it was because of how he looked, how he was dressed. I think one of the things he said is that he looks black. He looks like he's, you know, in a troublemaker. And, you know, it's an example of how, quite frankly, I mean, racial profiling can kill. It can be fatal.
And so what's the solution here? And what do you as a public defender tell your staff to do to address this concern of bias?
Well, I think bias exists everywhere. And that's why even in my office, and this is a recent revelation for me, because somebody asked me one time, well, do you do any racial sensitivity training in your office? I'm like, hey, we're public defenders. You know, we fight against injustice every day. And people were saying, well, it doesn't mean that, you know, your staff is immune from racism or sexism or, you know, or classism. And I have to agree with that, that, you know, if as a public defender, I go to work every day thinking that my clients are guilty, thinking that they should all be pled out, I'm going to have a very different attitude than somebody who goes in there that looks at our clients as people, who they are. They're people. And so, you know, I think on one level within the legal profession, whether you're a DA's office or police officer, there has to be that level of education where people are made aware of their biases and that it's okay to acknowledge your bias. When I question a jury on biases, I will say to them, I have biases. I, you know, feel a certain way, you know, when I see this person, that person approaching my car in the Tenderloin and I'm getting in my car. And you have to admit those things. The second thing that we have to do is we have to look at incarceration rates. We have to look at prosecution rates. We have to be honest and say, why are we prosecuting so many children of color? Why are disproportionately kids in the juvenile justice system from this zip code or that zip code? And these are some of the discussions I'm looking forward to having with the district attorney and the police chief and others, because unless we address these fundamental inequities in terms of the way that our criminal justice system is institutionalizing people, we're not going to get to a point where, you know, we can truly say we have a fair and just system.
I want to turn next to some of the other recent developments, like the Edward Snowden leaks and the ongoing placement of cameras in certain parts of high crime areas of San Francisco, like the Tenderloin and Western Addition. This idea of government surveillance, how do you feel that this has affected or will affect the people that you represent moving forward? And what's your sense on how to approach these concerns?
Well, you know, a few years ago, actually, it was probably 8 years ago, we had this whole debate in San Francisco over crime cameras. And, you know, if you go to the UK, I mean, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of cameras. I saw that there's a movie that's coming out called Closed Circuit about all the how everything that everyone does is captured somewhere. You know, now we find out that the government is looking at emails and everything else. So, yeah, we're in a new day and age where, you know, technology is really, you know, overriding the Fourth Amendment. And even the president has had to address this. You know, and I think we're going to find more and more renegades who are out there who are just going to say, you know what, you know, this information, you know, needs to be known. And we don't even know the extent to that our own government is spying against us. And I think part of the fact that all these leaks are coming out now is that, you know, people who find out about this are outraged by it. If you believe in the sanctity of you know, privacy that we should enjoy as citizens, you would be and you should be outraged by government intrusion. But it's becoming more and more difficult to make that argument as we become more enmeshed in technology, where if you're buying stuff on eBay, they know what you buy. If you're buying stuff on this website or that website, they know more about you than you know about yourself.
And do you feel, are you concerned that the people you represent, the populations that you represent, the poor among us, are going to be disproportionately affected? Is this another area of concern, disproportionately affected by government surveillance than perhaps people of other economic status?
Well, you know, I don't know that they're going to be directly affected by this. Certainly, in terms of like video and surveillance cameras, that becomes more and more of our practice. Almost every case now has some video evidence that's being offered. So that certainly affects our clients. But I think that when you're talking about the rights of criminal defendants, and particularly of poor people, we're kind of on the front line because we are fighting for those basic constitutional rights. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, right not to incriminate yourself. You know, most average people walking down the streets aren't going to understand or appreciate these rights unless it's taken away from them. And that's why it's important that public defenders exist and are fighting for those rights.
They kind of hold the line for the rest of us, perhaps.
Yeah.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight was San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton and Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host David Onick next Monday for a back-to-school special with members of San Francisco's Board of Education. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.